Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson. On Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
College commencement ceremonies are happening across the country and right here in the state of Utah today. And the headlines over the last few weeks have, of course, focused on college campuses, protests, riots, occupation, division. We want to get past the headlines of all of that because we want to figure out the way across all of those divides and look at what are the principles. What are the principles that graduates and the rest of us, for that matter, should be focused on as we enter graduation season? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it is always a good day when we can have Ibu Patel on the show. And it's even better today because we have you in the state of Utah in studio today. Ibu Patel, of course, is the founder and president of Interfaith America, an impact scholar for the University of Utah, and a commencement speaker up on campus tonight. Welcome back to the Beehive State.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
So obviously there's a lot of contention, a lot of questions going on about what is happening on college campuses. You're going to go speak to a large group of graduates today. What should they be thinking about?
Well, there's a lot that's happening on campuses right now. There's actually a great line by Susan Sontag. She once said, whatever is happening, there is always something else going on. So if the only thing you're seeing on college campuses right now is things that are insulting and offensive and disruptive, I want you to know that there's also peaceful protests happening. People just saying, stop the war.
Yeah.
And if all you're seeing is people who are peacefully protesting, I promise you there's disruptions happening also. So let's keep the whole in mind. But my message today at the University of Utah is you need to be a leader in diverse democracy. Mm. You need to take the privilege of this education and be grateful to the people who helped you cross this stage and to take that privilege and to lead. And in my mind, being a leader in a diverse democracy is not just knowing about the abstract ideals of freedom of speech and the right to vote, but also doing something in your home. And I think the thing people should do is host a potluck.
The potluck democracy, I think, is we may need to chisel that in granite somewhere, that it is the key. So break that down for us. Give us the essence of the potluck and how each of us can participate in that potluck of democracy.
Yes, well, Boyd, as you're suggesting, like I love the idea of a potluck as kind of a metaphor for our democracy, right? And there's a concreteness to it also, which I'll get to in a moment. But we often talk about the United States as a melting pot. Mm. The problem with that is that it requires people to melt their distinctive identities down into some kind of a common goo. And nobody wants to do that, right?
Yeah.
Muslims don't want to do that. And my Mormon friends don't want to do that. So you want to keep your distinctiveness. You're proud of that. But too often these days, diversity is presented as a battlefield. That's terrible also. We can't always just be fighting each other. So how should we think of diversity? We should think of it as a potluck. People should bring their distinctive dish to a common table. Those distinctive dishes are often inspired by a particular identity, whether you're from Poland or whether you're Potawatomi Indian, right? You have a distinctive identity that shapes your distinctive dish. But you bring it to a common table where those different dishes can be in creative combination and where people of diverse identities and divergent ideologies can be in enriching conversation.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Doesn't happen unless somebody raises their hand and says, I'm going to host a potluck.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up my home. I'm going to create a safe space, and I'm going to issue an invitation to a diverse set of people to bring their best dish to the table.
Yeah, I love that on so many levels. And I think as we not only value that diversity, because nobody wants a goo, nobody wants to eat that melted down. Oneness is not sameness in this country. And when we recognize that not just the dignity in our differences, but the divinity in our differences. You often talk about that in terms of kind of that sacred space, that holy ground where that happens. Kind of walk us through that as it relates to this.
Well, yeah, I think it's really powerful that the way we speak of the United States, the metaphors we use are very often sacred metaphors, right? City on a hill, that's biblical. Beloved community, cathedral of humanity, almost chosen people, better angels of our nature. I don't think this is an accident. Like, I really think that people from the four corners of the earth, speaking different languages, praying in different ways, coming to a single patch of ground and attempting to build out of it a nation, I think that that's a sacred project. And it deserves our best efforts, and it deserves contributing to it. It deserves being clear when it fails its ideals, as in the cases of slavery and Jim Crow, et cetera. And mostly it deserves our attempt to make it better. Yeah. So let's make it better.
Yeah. As you're up there tonight for this graduation, looking at that message of how do we come to that table and how do we go about that, one of the things that you and I were talking about earlier today that I think is so important is that when you create that invitation, you make the call for the potluck, but for some people that's a little harder, a little more difficult. Some of those barriers prevent them from contributing, and I think we're at a time in our community, in our country, where we need every voice.
That's right. That's right. A potluck is less delicious if some people can't bring their dish. Mm. And we have to understand that one of the reasons potlucks are so powerful is because they express the deep essence of both democracy and divinity, which is everybody's a contributor. Mm-hmm. Everybody's made in the image of God. In the Muslim tradition, we believe everybody is given the breath of God. Everybody is a contributor, but not everybody faces the same circumstances. Some people are born in stocked kitchens with excellent transportation, and some people are born with in a kitchen with bare cupboards, and they're walking everywhere with bare feet, right? And we need to look at those barriers straight in the eye. There's racism. There's poverty. There's homophobia. There's anti-Semitism. There's Islamophobia. These are bad things. Now, they don't define people. Islamophobia is not at the center of Muslim identity. Islam is at the center of Muslim identity.
Right.
Some of my friends make that mistake. They think Islamophobia is what makes Muslims. Actually, it's inspiration from Islam that makes Muslims. But we need to reduce Islamophobia so that Muslims can bring our hummus and our biryani to the table. We need to reduce anti-Semitism so Jews can bring their tabbouleh and their wonderful dishes to the table, right? We need to make sure that we are recognizing how important it is that people are contributors, that we're creating a common space for people to bring those distinctive contributions, and that we're reducing barriers so that everybody has an easier time making that contribution.
Yeah. One of the other things that you and I talked about earlier today was this power to convene, the ability to offer the invitation is in some ways you uniquely American. In some ways, it's the most powerful thing we have to simply invite and convene.
Invitation is how every good thing happens, right? It's how people start volunteering. Mm. Somebody else invites them to do that. It's how people work on political campaigns. It's how people run for office. It's how people join clubs. The invitation is what happens. And so that's one of the most powerful things about being a leader and a host of a potluck or in any other way is you are standing up and saying, I am stepping into this and I am inviting you to join me. Yeah. And collectively, we're going to create something beautiful.
Yeah.
Collectively, we're going to create something beautiful.
I love that. And we always say that the beginning to a solution to any problem is the moment someone says, let's talk about it. Let's come together.
Yes.
And I know at Interfaith America, your organization, you're extending that invitation to come talk about it in a lot of different ways. Tell us about some of that work.
That's right. Well, right now we're doing a lot of work with college campuses. Mm-hmm. And people don't see it because there's so much conflict that's high profile right now. But we're really working with college campuses, starting with the University of Utah, really, to help reset the default setting to cooperation and away from confrontation.
Yeah.
We need to really train the bridge builders. And we need to celebrate the peacemakers. We need to say that what we excel at in a diverse democracy is building bridges across disagreements.
Yeah.
And that's a skill. And it takes knowledge and it takes training. And that's what we should be focused on our college campuses and beyond, is helping people build the bridges of understanding and cooperation. And that's the work that we do at Interfaith Youth Corps, everywhere from presidents of universities right down to entering first-year students.
Oh, fantastic. Well, everyone is looking forward to your address tonight, part of commencement up at the University of Utah. Eboo Patel, a vital voice in our country and in our community. You've been a big blessing to us through your writing through Deseret News and Deseret.com. We always love having you on the show. And I think you're, again, one of those vital voices in the country that's going to call us all to the table so we can have a little better potluck and a much better democracy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Boyd.
Lots to think about, lots to unpack there as we listen to Eboo Patel and all of these conversations that should be happening on campus. What we celebrate actually matters, and I think we tend to focus on those that are doing the things that are unlawful as opposed to the peaceful protesters or those who are showing dignity across their differences, who are having a higher level conversation. There's a lot of things that I hope our graduates from every university, from every college, from every high school this year recognize, and that is if they can stay curious and humble, if they can engage in civic conversations, then we're all going to get to that creative combination where we actually form a more perfect union. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, we're staying with the conversation when it comes to graduation, commencement exercises happening around the state and across the country. And while a lot of the attention on college campuses has been in the space of protest and problems, there's also a host of really important messages that are being delivered. And someone who's going to be down at Utah Valley University speaking at their commencement is someone who understands, I think, what the essence of Utah Valley is all about. I've often described the students down there as gritty, tenacious, scrappy. And Jamie Kern Lima is co-founder of IT Cosmetics, a company she ultimately sold to L'Oreal. And she's also a best-selling author, a speaker, a champion of women, a philanthropist, and probably 27 other things all before 9 a.m. And Jamie, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What a great thing to be down there with the graduates at Utah Valley University, the commencement ceremony happening. And give us a sense in terms of how you're approaching this. You've been in so many big boardrooms, big national stages. Now you got a group of graduating students. What's the message for them today?
Yeah, well, I'm honored to be here. It's such a special group, you know, over 10,000 students graduating in the class at UVU. And what I am particularly excited about and just feel so blessed to be here for is over 3,000 of them are first generation students, which I was as well when I graduated college. And I'm going to talk all about, I was a Denny's waitress, and I had a lot of self-doubt, and I also had big dreams, but I didn't know how to believe that, you know, my dreams would happen to someone like me. And I learned a lot of lessons from launching a business in my living room, eventually building it to over 1,000 employees, selling it to L'Oreal for $1.2 billion cash. And it's been quite a journey so far. And what I'm going to share is hopefully some of the lessons that maybe will save them some nights crying themselves to sleep that I've been through, and hopefully just, you know, help them believe that, you know, them exactly as their creator made them are fully qualified, fully capable of accomplishing the dreams on their heart, even if they've had maybe a different type of a journey than everyone else. And I know with the graduating class, the youngest is 16 today and the oldest is 71. Mm. So I am so inspired by that and just, so grateful to be here.
There's so many amazing stories there at Utah Valley University, as you mentioned, 16-year-old all the way to a 71-year-old. And I want to get to a couple of the things that you talk about a lot, and you don't give advice, you live advice. I think that's the important thing. And your whole concept of believe it, how to go from underestimated to unstoppable. And one of the things that has jumped out to me in your story, Jamie, is just that willingness as an entrepreneur to just keep going, even when it didn't look so good or feel so good. You spent 3 years, didn't take a penny out of your business. No one but an entrepreneur knows what it's like to pay the employees and then put your own paycheck back in the drawer. But describe that for us.
Yeah, it was a journey of a lot of no's. I think most people who've started a business, we think, if I have a great product or a great idea, it's just going to work. And then we learn like, oh, wow, it's actually a lot harder than we thought. And my journey was really years and years and years of hundreds of no's, trying to get my product into stores and just from potential investors to retailers, just no after no after no after no. And, you know, one of the things that I plan to share with the graduates today is you know, a lot of us are tempted to give up after one no or five no's or 20 no's, or we start to let other people's no's kind of like turn into doubt in our own head, or doubt about our idea, or doubt about our dreams. And what I learned to do when I look back and go, how did I make it through all of that and keep going and not give up? And one of the things that I really learned to do was, like, every time I would get still and pray and ask God, like, okay, why do I feel like I'm supposed to do this, but everyone is saying no? Like, all of these people I'm so tempted to put on pedestals, but I have so much respect for. Experts are saying that they don't think what I'm doing is going to work. And every time I would get still and I would pray about it, I would get this knowing, like this knowing that said I'm supposed to keep going. And I think learning to trust that knowing inside of you, whether, you know, for you, it comes from God, or, you know, I know some people have different beliefs. For me, it's definitely my faith, but trusting that knowing inside of you over all the no's that might be happening around you, I think can be the single biggest difference in, you know, stepping into the calling on your life versus, you know, doubting yourself out of your own destiny.
Ah, that's so powerful. And I think it's such an important one that, we always say every no means there's got to be a better yes somewhere else. And keeping that perspective, describe for us just a little bit, I think part of that journey for the graduates is the ups and downs. You know, it's when things are going great, everything's great, and then it's not. And how do you ride those waves of the good times and the bad times and sustain yourself, sustain that momentum over time? I think that's the test of any individual or any organization.
Yeah, I think a lot of times, you know, why people give up or they quit is they haven't, you know, they're doing something that sounds good, but they haven't, you know, or maybe it pays a lot of money, or maybe someone said they should do it, or, you know, whatever. But have they really asked themselves, you know, why I want to do this? What's my why for really doing this? And really getting still and turning inward. We're in such a world right now where everything is outward, you know, everyone's posting social media selfies and everything's about, you know, external approval. And I think it's so important on that journey, because no matter what, I don't know a single person, no matter if they're, you know, a world changing thought leader, someone who's moved humanity forward, I don't know a single person who's not gone through ups and downs and failures and setbacks. And I think the most important thing is, you know, one of the most important is when we really know why we're doing what we're doing. Because a lot of people, you know, they have a goal or a dream. It could be personal. It could be a fitness goal. It could be a goal in their career. It could be the business that they're launching or the profession they want to go in. And really thinking, like, what is your why, your deep why for wanting to do what you do? And a lot of times people haven't kind of thought that through. And so when times get tough, I mean, for me, when I launched my company, I knew, you know, I had this mission, not just to create great products, but I really wanted to shift the definition in the whole beauty industry to be a lot more inclusive, to have women of all ages and shapes and sizes and skin tones. And because my life growing up, I always kind of saw those photoshopped images of beauty, and they always made me feel like I wasn't enough. Yeah. And so I kind of had this God-sized dream to shift the whole definition of beauty and the whole beauty industry, like for every little girl who is about to start seeing those ads and start doubting herself, and every grown woman who still does. Mm-hmm. And that why really deep for me. My why wasn't just, oh, I want to make great products because they'll work and help people, although I certainly wanted to do that. But going deeper, I'm like, why do I really want this thing? Because then it's sort of this tool that you lean on when times get tough. When it's something, and I have found when it's a why that's bigger than yourself, it's so much more powerful to just have that. And it becomes a North Star in a way on your journey. And we can do that for every part of our life, even goals, or, you know, relationship goals, or the goal to end a relationship, the goal to end an unhealthy friendship, having a real why that you can lean on is just such a great tool.
So I love that.
So
good. And so powerful, and the perfect ending, I think, for a lot of those students down at Utah Valley University. The commencement ceremony will celebrate the transformative power of education. Over 10,000 graduates, 3,400 plus that are first generation students. And Jamie Kern Lima, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to hearing your message to those students tonight at Utah Valley University.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you for having me. Everyone can join the party. They can watch it live stream. They could join us. And we're really, really, really excited. So thank you so much.
All right. Awesome. Jamie Kern Lima, another commencement speaker tonight at Utah Valley University. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, we've been watching a lot of things take place on college campuses. We've talked a lot about what's going on in classrooms across the country. And now we're going to get to the stuff that I really love, the radical creativity that seems like common sense, that makes a real difference and can actually transform not only classrooms, but individual lives more importantly. Really thrilled to have joining us on the program today, Joanna Slater, a national correspondent for The Washington Post. She focuses on the Northeast. She's also an award-winning foreign correspondent. Her career includes assignments in the United States, Europe, and Asia, and has just a fantastic piece in The Post. You need to check it out. It's about a Connecticut middle school that is hitting some of the battles our young people are facing in a way that is making a real difference. And Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with where you began your piece, with some of that, we call it within the parentheses of a crazy idea, Raymond Dolphin, assistant principal at a middle school in Connecticut. Tell us the story.
Sure. So Ray Dolphin has been assistant principal of this middle school near Hartford for 2 years. It's got more than 800 students. It's a big school. And one of the main challenges he saw students facing was their inability to get away from their cell phones, despite the fact that there was a school rule against it. Most schools in the U.S., 3/4 of schools in the U.S. have rules preventing cell phone use in class. But in practice, that's not how it usually works out, and that's not how it was working out at this school in Connecticut. It meant that individual teachers really had to enforce this rule, which meant a kind of daily power struggle between students and teachers, teachers telling students to put the phones away. Sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't. So Ray Dolphin, this assistant principal, as you said, decided to look for a more creative and dramatic way to change things.
Yeah. So as of course, you go down that path, there's always hit resistance within the parentheses of a crazy idea. And I'm guessing that as he went down this path, there were probably a few moans and groans from the students and maybe even louder ones from the parents.
100%. The students definitely did not want it to happen. Now, one of the 8th graders I talked to told me that he cried when he heard it was going to happen. And there were petitions urging the school administration to reconsider, petitions by the students. The school did not reconsider. But there was, as you point out, there was significant opposition from parents, not all parents, not most parents, but certainly there were parents who did not want this to happen. They had their objections fell into a couple of categories. And those categories, Ray Dolphin told me, he felt that 3 of them were legitimate, but they were things that they were going to deal with. So one of them, of course, parents are worried about reaching their kids in an emergency, in the worst case scenario, yeah, which unfortunately we have to acknowledge, right?
Yeah.
But he says that in a daily reality, there are ways that there's a landline in every classroom, sometimes more than one, and the teachers will still have their cell phones. So you'll always be able to call 911. And in a real emergency, having kids take out their cell phones and call folks is actually not what you want them doing. So they dealt with that objection. There were some parents who really felt like their kids needed their cell phones to manage their anxiety. They relied on meditation apps and music, but they created special accommodations for those kids for the first couple weeks, and all of those kids are fine now, he said. And then you had parents who just love the convenience of being able to be in touch with their kids throughout the school day. Right? For those parents and those kids, they had to go back to a little bit more old-fashioned way of contacting kids, which was leaving messages with the school office. One of my favorite parts of this story was when one of the administrators told me that because if kids need to call their parents, they also can go to the school office. And for some of these kids, it was the first time they'd ever used a landline. They literally didn't know how to use it.
education at its best there.
Exactly.
So let's get into some of the results. Obviously, the hand-wringing on the front end from everybody, we get that. And as you pointed out, some of those are really legitimate things, and it sounds like they navigated those really well. But let's get to the results, because everybody's so panicked of what will or won't happen. Here's someone who actually just put it to the test. What were the results?
So the results, if you ask the teachers are just thrilled. They're the ones who really were on the front lines of dealing with this day in and day out. And some of them expressed some skepticism that this would work. If you talk to the administrators at the school, they said the key is not just the device, the pouch. The students put their phones into a synthetic rubber pouch that's magnetically locked, and then they unlock it at the end of the day. But it's not just the pouch, because sometimes students can get around the pouch. It's that there's a uniform school rule that if a cell phone does come out, in whatever way, the student gets sent to the office and they get a detention. Mm. So it's out of teachers' hands now. So the teachers say that they see students that are, they say the students are more focused. I was really struck by what one teacher said to me. He said, now the first thing I can say to students is good morning, not take your AirPods out. Just what he used to have to do every single period throughout the day. There, if you talk to the students in groups, there is still a lot of peer pressure to say they don't like it. But when you talk to them one-on-one, it's quite different. They acknowledge that they're less distracted, that there's also less drama. One of the math teachers told me that especially right after lunch, when the students would come back into class, they would be really keyed up on social media related gossip, you know, who was in a fight with whom and who is, et cetera. He said, now that's all gone. And then I think what was most touching to me was students talking about actually speaking with each other more.
The really radical stuff, having a conversation with one of your peers. And you also mentioned there was a quote from one of the students who kind of had that whole fear of missing out. If I don't have my phone, I'm missing out on the rest of the world's going by. And that most of them realized that they really don't miss that much, if anything at all. And the connections they make with each other and with their teachers, their ability to actually get the work done definitely seems to be going up.
Right. I think that is one of the most interesting aspects of this, which is that their social world is actually their world at school.
Yeah.
It's not what's on the phones. It's in their classrooms and in with those 20 kids or however many kids there are in that classroom, which, of course, is quite different than what it was before.
Wow. That's so powerful. And I think when we can get classrooms and schools to no longer just be another place of virtual reality, but it becomes reality, all those conversations change. This is a crucial conversation I think we need to have across the country and in our own communities. Joanna Slater from the Washington Post, brilliant piece, really, really great storytelling and a great focus on results and impact. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's Joanna Slater from the Washington Post. And someone in Connecticut just said, you know what, we're just going to do it. And so they did. And the benefits are becoming very clear in terms of what students are learning, how they're feeling, that anxiety is going down, that connection is going up, loneliness goes down. And I bet conversations at home are a little bit different as well. Those are all good things. We got to check it out. We got to implement that kind of creativity in all our classrooms. All right, we'll step aside for a quick break. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And as we do divide the rage from the reason, one place where rage often lives and often drives is fundraising. The game of political fundraising continues to change. Of course, it's being driven in large part by clicks and clickbait kinds of things for those online donors across the country. We want to get underneath the headlines of that. I think we all get that in our email box or in a text message. As campaigns are trying to drive and gain cash going into primaries and general election season. Jessica Piper is a reporter at Politico, and with some of her colleagues did a real interesting deep dive into online donations and what it's doing to fuel this particular election cycle. And Jessica, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's start with just the where are we as it relates to online donations. Obviously, it's changed the game from the old school days where it was always press the flesh, in person, backroom handshake kind of stuff. Tell us where we are now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously 20 years ago, you know, political giving looked a lot different. People were writing checks at actual fundraisers. And obviously, you know, some of that still happens. But over the last two election cycles, we've seen online fundraising just absolutely take off. And what we've seen so far in the 2024 cycle is, you know, a little bit more stability in terms of online fundraising. You know, we were in a place a few years ago where, you know, numbers were doubling every cycle in terms of the number of donors and the amount of money. And now things seem to have leveled off a little bit. Sort of fundraising totals this cycle are fairly similar to last cycle. So we might be at a little more of a static point in that. And what we're seeing is, you know, millions of donors are giving online to you know, congressional campaigns, also presidential campaigns, and other groups too. And they're sending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter. So it's a massive force now.
Yeah. One of the things that you pointed out in your piece that I think is so important, it used to be that we would always say all politics is local and everything was local. One of the things that you noted, and I'd love for you to unpack it for us a little bit, is with this all of this online donation going on and this, these drives, these campaigns through social media and through email and all of those things, it's really turned a lot of that to almost everything is national now as opposed to local.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the campaigns that raise the most money are doing it because they're fundraising in a very national way. Like, ultimately, you know, our analysis looked at members of Congress and their challengers, you know, Senate campaigns, House campaigns. And what we found was that, you know, the candidates raising the most money were always, in most cases, a couple exceptions of California candidates, but they were getting more money from out of state than in state. And, you know, that's by design, right? Candidates recognize that they need a lot of money to fund their campaigns. They have competitive elections and they want to have the most resources available. And to do that, they have to fundraise from people who are not from their state or district. And what we see with that is that a lot of the messaging around this fundraising as well is driven by these kind of out-of-state issues, these kind of national issues. So, for example, on the Democratic side, like, you know, almost every Democratic candidate sends a lot of fundraising emails about abortion because that's an issue that really drives Democratic donors, you know, regardless of whether or not it's maybe a especially salient issue in the particular race. Whereas on the Republican side, you know, we see a lot of fundraising from congressional candidates that's about defending Donald Trump, you know, because Donald Trump is a force that really drives Republican donors, even though, like, you know, in an individual congressional race, like, there might not be a lot that a particular candidate can do to actually defend Donald Trump in that particular race. So we really see these issues are driving the fundraising messaging and they're energizing donors. And yeah, a lot of money is going across state lines, particularly for the candidates that are raising the most money.
Yeah. And as you look at that, it seems to me that this kind of fundraising does tend to play into what we're seeing everywhere. And that is kind of the performative politics, as you mentioned, whether it's going to Donald Trump's defense or it's a ruling by the Supreme Court. It's sort of the old, I always call it the shampoo bottle model of lather, rinse, repeat. You lather people up, you get them angry, frustrated, filled with angst. You let them rinse that off with a nice $20 or $50 contribution, and then you repeat. And it seems that part of this is just conditioning us to respond inappropriately to really negative base emotions in a lot of these campaigns. And as you pointed out, and I would be curious in your research and your dive on all of this, do we find that we are moving in the fundraising to everything is urgent? You talked about fundraising deadlines being a big driver. What else is driving it? What else seems to be working in terms of these, whether it's cross party state lines or right in the state?
Yeah, I think, you know, we see it's interesting because we see in terms of like the fundraising appeals candidates are sending, yeah, there's always a sense of urgency. There's always mentioning topics that are likely to rile, you know, prospective donors up and get them to hand over the money. One thing that I love doing with this analysis is I love looking at, you can actually see with online donations, like the number of donations that a candidate got in a given day. And so you can look at that for every day and see, you know, when was there a particular spike? And what we do see is that you can, you know, with a lot of candidates, then you can like, okay, there's a spike. So we go back and try to figure out what happened that day. Right. And you see that like candidates really do have their fundraising driven by moments that are about a lot more than just, you know, sending emails. So, you know, they might say every email's urgent, but donors really tune in when there's something more happening. So a great example of this, I think, from the first quarter was Representative James Comer of Kentucky, who had by far his best fundraising day of the quarter in early January. And it was where he had come out very strong against Hunter Biden and the conflict with the House Oversight Committee. And he had come out with a statement and a threat of subpoena. And while there was that ongoing conflict, and that also led to a flood of donations to his campaign because, you know, Republicans saw him standing up in this way and they really liked that.
Yeah.
And so I think what you see is like, yeah, that's an example of like a fairly niche event in Washington in one sense. But it really drove donations for a particular candidate. And you can find many examples with other candidates that are similar.
Yeah, it is. And you can almost do the mirror opposite on the left and the right and what they used and what triggered their particular donors to act on a particular day, I think is always just fascinating to look at. It is a lot of money going into a lot of campaigns. And you also noted that it's not necessarily going into campaigns that have a chance of winning or the issue that they're driving those fundraising dollars on may not be the big topic or the big deciding factor in it as well. And anyway, there's a ton of things in here. You need to check out her piece at the Washington Post, and just a really great, excuse me, I said Washington Post, Politico. I apologize, Jessica. I don't want to get you fired in this process. So Jessica Piper is a reporter at Politico. And Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Jessica Piper, a reporter at Politico. Definitely get the right brand there. And it is a very interesting deep dive on how online donations are fueling the election cycle. And I have email that I get from both the Democrats and the Republicans across the country. And I can tell when something happens because my email box lights up. And I'll get a host of things. Maybe it's all on the Democrats on a given day because something happened that they're either really angry about or want you to be angry about, so you'll donate. Or it's something on the Republican side that it was a victory or they're under attack or the fundraising deadline is, you know, coming very soon. If I get one more email that talks about what's happening on college campuses, because everybody wants you to donate regardless of where they fall on that particular issue, they want to raise money off of it. And one of the things that we have to do as citizens and as voters is vote with our wallets as well. And if we continue to follow the lather, rinse, repeat model, we'll continue to get that as the model in terms of how people who are supposed to be governing are spending all of their time just campaigning and raising campaign cash. So don't reward bad behavior. If you get a good email about a good issue that you care about, donate to that. But don't buy in to the lather, rinse, repeat, anger, fear, and frustration stuff. We can do better. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the headlines over the last several months, one that we've been following anyway, has been the exodus of members of Congress from both the political left and the political right, who are done, who are not running for re-election this year. And that's an interesting headline. But what if we could get underneath that headline and maybe even do a little exit interview? What would we learn? And could it help us actually change the direction and the effectiveness of Congress? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
This is a great Think Again moment, and we're actually going to do this for the next two segments of the program as we have an opportunity to speak with Amanda Sue, who's a reporter for the opinion video section of the New York Times as a member of the 2023-2024 class of Times Fellows. And they did just that, exit interviews with departing lawmakers. And Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a this was fantastic. When we saw this pop up, we're like, oh, we have to talk about this. This is I'm a firm believer in exit interviews, regardless of the institution or organization. And so, first, kind of give us the backstory. How did you get onto this? And then we'll get into some of the things that you learned along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think like many people, we've been tracking the news that there seem to be a lot of Congress members who are retiring this year. Since I think late last year, the New York Times newsroom had been publishing several articles announcing some of these higher profile departures, like former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, Senator Mitt Romney. And the idea came about in November when we had decided that we should strategically try to catch some of these lawmakers on their way out and ask them to give us sort of a peek behind the curtain for how Congress actually works and what it's like working there right now at this time of what seems like peak dysfunction.
Yeah. And you got all kinds of great insight as you did some of these exit interviews. Let's start with just kind of a high level in terms of what some of the underlying driving forces for many of these members of Congress who are saying, yeah, not going to run for reelection. I'm going to head back home.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different things. One of the questions that we asked the Congress members was your most frustrating experience or biggest frustration? And I think their responses to that were pretty illuminating. One of them mentioned, they called out their colleagues and said that a lot of Congress members these days tend to act in somewhat performative ways. And a lot of time it's about, grandstanding, getting these viral moments and campaigning versus actually doing the lawmaking itself. So that was one source of frustration. Another source of frustration was, the role of money in politics. We asked the question very directly, is Congress corrupt? And many Congress members did talk about how much time lawmakers have to spend campaigning and fundraising, and just how much of that time that takes up away from, again, the lawmaking, which is what they're sent there to do. And so I think there's a lot of different aspects of the job that they were frustrated with that kind of all combined together led to their desire to leave.
Yeah. As you went through this whole process, there's always some of those surprise moments in an exit interview. And I don't know if it's because people can be totally candid because they're on their way out the door or if they want to just fire one last shot across the bow to some of their colleagues that maybe they didn't get along with. What surprised you going through this process of the exit interview?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think counterintuitively what surprised me the most was how normal the Congress members were when we spoke to them. Like the lawmakers that we see who dominate cable news tend to be the ones that I referenced earlier who are sort of vying for those viral moments. And the ones that we spoke to, however, really broke that misconception maybe that I had. I'm not a Hill reporter or politics reporter by trade, so it was very illuminating for me to speak to some of these people who represent districts across the country and how genuine they seemed in their desire to actually try to make a difference and get things done and how exasperated they were with the institution, so much so that they are leaving. So yeah, I guess my own surprise was the fact that they were quite normal compared to what we see the representatives that we see making the news in Congress.
Yeah, I'm so glad you pointed that out, Amanda, because it is so easy to just watch those who are good at the we have an official term for it. It's a performative jackassery. And we see those folks all the time, and it's all we hear. And we reward bad behavior because we play it and we talk about it and we post about it. And yet there are so many who are far away from the cameras and the lights, and they're doing great constituent service work for the members in their state or in their district, and they're there for the right reason. And I don't think we celebrate those folks nearly enough. And so I'm glad you got to experience that. There really are some great people back in Congress.
Yes,
that should
absolutely
give us a little bit of confidence that there are some adults in the room from time to time. Give us one last thing in terms of a takeaway for you in terms of forward moving. Obviously, those that are leaving, many are part of that. We call it the flat forehead society, that they're just so tired of slapping their head saying, I can't believe we're going to do this today. They're going to go home and make a difference in their communities or go to another business and so on.
What gives you hope for the future based on what you heard from some of those exiting members of Congress?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a couple of things that give me hope. The first would be what I mentioned, the fact that there are Congress members who do seem to actually be trying very hard to fight for their constituents. Though I guess the flip side of that is a lot of those Congress members are the ones who are leaving. So it's hard to know, I guess, who we're left with and who's going to be running. But I did want to relay a sentiment that the Congress members all shared. We asked them the question, what gives you hope? And while it didn't make it into the final piece, across the board, every single Congress member said that what gave them hope was the youth, like the younger generations, and new people who are entering politics, and how engaged and politically active they are. And so I think that I would just like to echo that sentiment. That was part of the reason why in our conversations, they were talking about the importance of making politics and running for office more accessible to a broader swath of American people. Making it an institution that young people would desire to go work for.
Yeah.
Because I think right now the PR for Congress is pretty bad, and there's concerns over dissuading people who genuinely want to make a difference from running for office.
Yeah, oh, that's such great insight. I'm so glad you shared that, Amanda, because that really is the essence of it. There are great people, and we've got to make sure there's a path, because if all we do is allow the performative folks to hang around, we end up in a kakistocracy with the least qualified to govern doing all the governing. And this is such an important topic. We're going to stay with the conversation, and we're actually going to go and listen to some of those interviews that Amanda Sue and the team there at the New York Times put forward in these exit interviews with those members of Congress that are leaving the institution, going back home. Amanda Sue, reporter for the opinion video section of the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us today. Fantastic work. Great insight.
Thank you so much.
All right, when we come back, we'll listen to some of those exit interview answers from some of those members of Congress, give you some additional insight into what they've learned, what they detest, and what they hope we can do better moving forward. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, if you're just joining us, in the last segment, we spoke with Amanda Sue, a New York Times reporter in the opinion video section, who did exit interviews with 12 members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, who are not running for re-election. Always interesting. Exit interviews can be a very fascinating exercise, and especially for those leaving service in the House and in the Senate in our nation's capital. There's a lot of interesting things to glean from their experience there. I do love the fact that Amanda Sue in our last segment talked about the fact that she was surprised at how normal many of these people really were, that they weren't all the performative attention seekers that we often see and validate. We reward bad behavior way too often in this country. And so a lot of people think that every member of Congress is like that. And I love the fact that in their exit interviews that Amanda Sue was able to really see, there are some really, really good people, some good humans who are there for the right reason, who are focused on good public policy, who are worried about making sure they get it right, making sure they're being careful stewards of your money. Because that's what's being decided in a lot of these bills, and that ultimately whatever bills are passed are going to produce the right results for the American people. And there's a lot of members of Congress that fall into that category. And sadly, far too many of them run out of energy before they run out of opportunity. And so many of them are leaving, and we've seen a large number leaving here as we enter the 2024 election cycle, people who have said, I can make a bigger difference in my community or doing something else rather than dealing with the crazy factor of the minority of the minority of both parties in Washington, D.C. So let's get into the exit interviews. A lot of fascinating questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tee up the question that the New York Times asked these departing members of Congress. And then you're going to hear just a series of voices. I won't go through each time and tell you the names of all of these members. Just know there's 12 of them. And we'll kind of bounce through kind of the highlights of some of their answers. So the first exit interview question
that the New York Times asked these departing members was, describe Congress today in one word. Here's the montage.
One word I'd use to describe Congress, I would say...
Dysfunctional.
Chaotic.
It's just very challenging.
Difficult. Last year, when the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, they passed 27 bills, which made us the most unproductive Congress in any given year in the United States history.
Dysfunctional.
Tense.
Dysfunctional.
Misunderstood. The misunderstanding is that people are purposefully trying to not accomplish goals on behalf of the American people. That's just not true.
Challenging. Broken.
Challenging, broken, dysfunction. And a few little positives in there. A few things got done. And I think that's an important element to all of that. But it's interesting that these members that are leaving, that's what they're saying. That's how they're describing the circumstances that they've been working in during the last Congress. Next question was, reflecting on their own work and contributions, members were asked an important question. Did you make a difference during your time as a lawmaker? And these answers are really interesting, and it also shows the kind of focus and things that we often don't hear news reports about.
Most definitely.
For sure.
I really feel like I was able to make a difference.
66 bills.
Hundreds of amendments.
A couple $100 million from the water crisis in Flint.
Dealing with transportation, land use.
On national defense.
On healthcare issues.
I was the first woman to chair the health subcommittee.
Solve the surprise medical billing problem.
Expanding rural broadband.
Help write a bipartisan infrastructure bill that has the biggest investment ever in climate provisions.
I was responsible for passage of cancer screening coverage under Medicare.
Some of the bills that I carried for 8 and 10 years before they came to fruition.
It really appears to the public that all we do is fight when the reality is on 98% of the issues, there's great bipartisanship and people work together well and come up with good answers.
So I really reject the notion that you can't get things done.
I love that. It does give you a little bit of hope to say, okay, there is work being done. We just don't report on those issues nearly enough. The bipartisan stuff is not nearly as great as everything that screams and bleeds and is great for fundraising. And so it is important. And it's important as citizens that we look beyond just the headlines, as always, and look at what have they actually done? And how did it actually go through? And who worked together to make that pass? Because those kinds of things do matter. They do make a difference. And we need to focus far more on that. Next, these exiting members, this exit interview, they were asked, what worries you the most about the future? Take a listen to their answers.
I worry about the future of our democracy.
Are we going to protect our democracy?
The state of our democracy.
A lot of the concerns I have now are about the geopolitical climate around the world.
What worries me most is I'm not giving my grandkids the same country that my parents gave me. Social Security will be bankrupt within a few years. Medicare the same way. We can't sustain $34 trillion of debt. Right now, the incentive is to spend all the money that we don't have and put the burden on our grandchildren. Very simple solution. You need to change the incentive structure. For example, members of Congress don't get a salary unless they balance the budget, or they don't get to run for re-election unless they have reduced the amount of spending.
So a lot of interesting worries about the future. I think a lot of those worries are what we all worry about. Are we leaving the country a little bit better, or at least as promising as the one that we inherited? What are we doing to make sure that happens? And I think it's an important component to all of that. I want to close this out with something from Jared Kilmer. Now, Jared Kilmer is a Democrat lawmaker from Washington State. He chaired a committee that was affectionately nicknamed the Fix Congress Committee. So the Fix Congress Committee, I think we can all get on board for that. It was a bipartisan group, and it was asked to find out how to improve the state of Congress. Now, I recognize that is a big, big job, but during his exit interview, here are some of Representative Kilmer's thoughts about what it would take to improve Congress.
How do you have a more civil and collaborative institution? Set up time with this football coach who took over a team that had a notoriously corrosive culture, and he turned it into a winner. And I said, Coach, what do you do when you have players on the team trying to sabotage the team? And he said, well, I cut them. And I said, well, we don't really have that option. And then he asked me a question. He said, how do you do new player orientation? much of the orientation process is, you know, is an exercise in keeping the two parties from talking to each other. Okay, Democrats, you get on this bus, Republicans, you get on that bus. And this coach said to me, well, I don't know much about Congress, but it seems like you ought to stop doing that. And this last year, the orientation process actually involved Democrats and Republicans going through orientation together. And listen, someone could look at that and say, hey, bang up job, Kilmer, you know, Congress is clearly fixed. Obviously, that's not the case. We've passed 202 recommendations, and I actually think over time, you're going to see some positive change within the institution as a consequence of that work.
All right, now getting on the same bus and going through orientation together may seem like a pretty minor thing, but it is not, because it sets the tone and establishes the culture. And I can tell you from my time in D.C., I watched a number of members go through that process, and it is us and them. And the Republicans do get on one bus and they go to their, you know, RNC headquarters, and the Democrats get on another bus. They go to the DNC headquarters and they do orientation there. And then inside the Capitol, they go to their collective corners. And everything is about what you have to watch out for, who you have to watch out for, what you need to defend, what you do, who you do and who you don't talk to and why. And it's all very divisive from the beginning. We've talked about on this show before that I am a firm, passionate believer that culture eats strategy for breakfast. It's about culture. And if you establish the right kind of culture, which starts with orientation, Jared Kilmer, again, Democrat from Washington State, is retiring, is not running for re-election, but he was part of this Fix Congress committee, and he said, this is where we should begin. Let's do orientation together. Because after all, they really are on the same team. The team is the United States Congress. It's the United States House of Representatives. It's the United States Senate. It's not the Republican Senate. It's not the Democratic Senate. It's the United States Senate. And those are things that have to get fixed if we're going to get this thing right. Again, fantastic exit interviews. This was in the New York Times. You should check it out at thenewyorktimes.com. Amanda Sue, a reporter of the opinion video section for the New York Times, did fantastic work. Some really interesting, fascinating, even surprising comments from these members of Congress who are leaving the building because they've had it, had enough, and are going to go try to make a difference somewhere else. A lot to think about. We'll be right back. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Of course, we always say we should declare our independence, but what happens to the political parties when everybody, or the vast majority of people, decide, I think I'm going to be an independent. I'm not going to be a Republican or a Democrat. I'm going to be an independent.
With the three things you need to know this hour, I'm Dan Bomas. First, members of Chad Daybell. With the three things you need to know this hour,
I'm a little hostile takeover of the board. So that's what happens when someone declares their independence on the board. We're going to dive into this whole issue and what it means for the political parties as more independence is declared by actual voters. Jared Alpers, the political director at Good Party, an organization aiding independent political candidates in their efforts. And Jared, welcome to the show.
Hey, Boyd. Nice to be with you.
You had a great piece at The Hill, thehill.com, talking about this movement towards more independent voters. Give us kind of the lay of the land. Give us the numbers. What is it looking like out there?
You know, I think a lot of folks are looking this political season and are looking around wondering what has happened to the state of our country. I think for the first time, though, there are a lot of folks who are aligning and are seeing, especially at the top of the ticket, but also just at the landscape generally, dissatisfaction at not any one particular person or party, but at the whole state of our politics in this country. And it's a problem that's been created by a really stale, tribal, chaotic, and in many instances, and increasingly, corrupted political system. And the impact that it has had is that people are broadly disaffiliating and increasingly looking for alternatives to those two parties. I see numbers every day that are holding steady at 60%+ of the country look at both parties or look at the parties unfavorably. 63% are dissatisfied with the choices that they're being forced to make if they're participating at all in our political system each year. And only 4% of our voters polled in a really comprehensive Pew study that was done at the end of last year are looking at our political system and saying that the system is working well, which means almost 95% of the country is losing faith in our institutions.
Yeah, and I think that's such a worrisome thing. I think it because it's also fraying the fabric of society as we lose trust in leaders, we lose trust in institutions of government, we lose that civil society, and we lose trust in each other as neighbors and friends. And I think that downstream ripple is really worrisome. As you look at how it's playing out in the politics, you mentioned kind of the binary choice that nobody's happy about, especially at the top of the tickets this year in 2024. One of the things that you have talked about, and I think a lot of other organizations have spoken to, is we have to actually get to why are they leaving if we ever actually want to get back to where people are anxious and happy to engage in the political process.
Yeah, I think that it would be a good place to start if you're a political, you know, strategist who's deeply affiliated with one of the two parties. And frankly, it's a level of introspection that I think those of us who are on the outside looking in are wondering how they're missing it. When you're an independent voter, I think the reflexive tactic of the parties is to be dismissive and say, independents aren't real. You know, at the end of the day, they're gonna be forced to like the taste of the food as it goes down. Even though the largest coalition, even going back to 2020, the largest coalition of people who were eligible to vote in this country were those who didn't participate in the 2020 election. It was 83 million voters who were eligible to vote sat on the sidelines.
Yeah.
That doesn't account for the people who do participate, but are those classic lesser of two evils voters. And so I think it's imperative for people who are trying to understand this problem in particular to acknowledge the culpability of the parties at how they participated in us getting here.
Yeah.
And then think, well, what can we do better?
Yeah, I think that's so crucial. And I think as we look at that, to me, both of those numbers are stunning and disturbing, that we have so many who have disconnected from the process because they're just exhausted and exasperated by it. They've had enough and they're busy living their lives and working at their jobs and raising their kids and coaching Little League and making a difference for their neighbor. But we've got to create a space to do that. You mentioned in your piece in The Hill some of the efforts out there, places like No Labels, some of these other independent groups, and even more so than coming up with another party, although the numbers you described, they're actually the majority. They could immediately banish the Democrats and the Republicans to minority mm-hmm. status if they would all come together in a moment. But what do you see coming next? And tell us a little bit about what your organization is doing to simply assist, not be a party, but to assist
right.
in raising those voices.
Yeah, and you touched on something really important, which is the maybe logical. I know that there's an effort to get people to participate, and I think that in a healthy and functional democracy, people should be participating. But one of the direct consequences of forcing people to make unfavorable decisions cycle after cycle is that folks become rationally apathetic. That's a term that we throw around at Good Party a lot. Mm. And it means people are very reasonably disconnecting because they're tired and burnt out from having to participate in a system that they have no faith in delivering the results to the problems that they see.
Yeah.
And so my organization, Good Party, is really focused not on building and scaling an alternative political party. So we're friends with those who are doing it, whether it's the Forward Party or we work with the Libertarians, the Greens, No Labels. When they were really trying to build and scale their effort, we have nothing but warm feelings for people who are trying to introduce competition at all levels of government into our political system. Our focus in particular is to offer the infrastructure that the parties have spent decades investing in to be able to produce competitive candidates, and especially down ballot.
Yeah.
For us, we're focused on helping recruit, train, elect, and support candidates who are looking at these two parties and saying, my only option is to sort of bite the bullet and pick a party that is the least sort of offensive to my personal or maybe the most closely aligned to my personal politics, or not run at all because independents don't win. And for us, we're trying to change that narrative by producing technology that can help them run competitive campaigns that are built on the professional best practices that the parties have adopted, and help them run competitive campaigns to hopefully give communities across the country, and especially in races like city council or school board or county elections, the opportunity to vote for something that is not, you know, a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat or Republican anymore.
Yeah. Great perspective. This is a really important effort. You can check it out at Good Party. Jared Alper, political director at Good Party. This is an organization, independent, helping those independent voices have some of those resources to compete in the marketplace of ideas, which can get us out of those lesser of two evil choices and get to a better solution. Jared, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Boyd.
All right, that's Jared Alper, political director at Good Party. That's a good discussion about how do we get to those who have disengaged and those who are sitting on the sideline, those who are just exhausted and exasperated. We can do better at this. It's going to take each of us to step up and do better at this. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We are really thrilled and honored today to have joining us in the studio Khosrow Semnani, an extraordinary entrepreneur, an extraordinary philanthropist, someone who goes about doing good, making a difference every day in our community, and have been doing it for so long. Khos, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Boyd. You're being too kind. I don't deserve it all.
I just call balls and strikes. It is. That's the truth. We focus on the truth here on this show.
You
have been such an important part of our community for so many years. Your businesses have been successful, but more important, you're always looking for a way to make a difference. And we had the chance to spend a day together at the summit, the Kindness Summit, just a few weeks ago at the University of Utah. And you and the Semnani Family Foundation are the driving force behind that. And give us a little bit of the backstory. How did that all come about?
Backstory, that's a good way of putting it. Well, I just quickly tell you, I'm an immigrant that I came here years ago. I got dropped off over at the Greyhound bus depot, not too far from the station. That was over 50 years ago.
Wow.
I didn't know how lucky I was that I was in Utah, and that's where I stayed. And it's been home and for myself, my family, my wife, of course, and it's been a great place to work. And what is so really important and that really distinguishes Utah, at least, you know, my experience, is the people here are exceptionally kind and welcoming to people from other places, exceptionally, very welcoming. They give me opportunities to do things. And, of course, philanthropy was a cornerstone of, you know, many things that I've done, and I've been blessed that I'm able to be part of the solution.
Yeah.
And that is important. And taking advantage of that, I'm hoping that we can continue to do more. And we started this One Kind Act a Day. It's our last, I shouldn't say the last, but latest project.
Yeah.
I hope you have other ones.
Many, many to come. And part of that One Kind Act was this summit up at the University of Utah. And it was such an amazing collection of people and stories and so many extraordinary things of people just doing good because they can, and because they're willing to just make that effort to make a difference.
Well, let me tell you a secret. The secret is when you're kind, you're happier. That's the secret.
Yeah.
And people are, I think by nature, they're kind if given opportunity and reminded of. And makes you happy, makes your day go a lot easier. And you can be kind to every strangers, your family, your friends, the environment, anything, to animals.
Yeah.
And being kind is something that I believe we can all share, regardless of religion, race, language, background.
Yeah.
And kindness is promoted by everybody.
Yeah.
And that's what we are hoping to accomplish, and to remind them, and people be happier.
Yeah. And we do. We get so busy. We chase and we race around on things that we're working on. And sometimes we forget that little moment, that little opportunity to stand up and really, really make a difference. You put some great challenges out into the community, because sometimes we think, oh, you know, I have to do some big project on the other side of the world, or I have to be part of some amazing transformation. But it is neighbor helping neighbor in need, but it's also businesses being active and leaning into their community. So businesses need to be part of this One Kind Act today.
I couldn't agree with you more, Boyd. Every business that I've known that they have been respectful and kind to their customers, to their associates, to their own employees. Mm-hmm. They've done very well. And I can tell you that for a fact. The professor at the University of Utah, which I'm in liberty of sharing his name, Dr. Noah Gardner, he actually spoke in one of our events, and he said that there's scientific information that people who actually are kind, they're happier. When they're happier, they're more productive. And when they're more productive, they're most courteous. And their businesses do very well. I'm happy to tell you Zions Bank has always joined us. University of Utah is not a business, but it's an institution, major institution, joined us. Many other businesses that they've come across that they've been already working with us in Highland High School, Highland Elementary School, a number of schools that have already joined us. So they're very happy.
Yeah, I love that. As these organizations and schools, youth organizations are all signing up, and they can go to thepowerofkind.org. They can take that pledge. They can become a place of kindness. Some of the stories that we heard up at the summit were just extraordinary to me. Some of these young kids making goals of, you know, 10,000 acts of kindness, and I think they ended up doing 30 or 40,000, as only kids could. But it does have that multiplier effect. And as you were talking about those businesses, someone who's done an act of kindness is going to feel better, will be more productive. So it's actually good business to be kind.
Yes, the businesses that they are kind, their people are happier, they can communicate, mm-hmm. they can do things better. It's just a different atmosphere of working with customers, and that really makes a huge difference.
Yeah, no question about that.
I agree.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of the day that I just keep thinking about, and I think it was a special moment for you as well. We live in an age that is so divisive on so many different things. But we had religious leaders from across the faith spectrum on stage for almost an hour, and you could have heard a pin drop up there at the University of Utah. What was it that made that so important and so special for you?
We all come from different backgrounds, actually. And when I was thinking about what it is that we all have in common, regardless of our religion, race, language, everything else, all religions, they promote kindness. Mm. All parents promote kindness to their children. So I said, this is the common denominator, which is we all have.
Yeah.
I just have to remind them. So our whole campaign revolves around that. And in the words of President Randall of University of Utah, he said we should have Kindness Summit not only once a year. We should have it once every month.
Mm.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's just a matter of logistics, putting it together.
Yeah.
But honestly, I mean, the kindness that we all have in common, we can share that. We had Archbishop of Catholic Church, Bishop of Salt Lake City, Bishop Solis. We had Rabbi Spector. We had from Muslim Imam Yasser. We had Bishop Spiegel.
Yeah.
Yes. And, we had all these wonderful people. They all came, sat there and arms in arms and just supporting the whole idea of kindness. And that's like I said, regardless of your religion or race or language, kindness is an international language.
Yeah.
We all share that.
It really is. And I was having a hard time being the moderator because I was taking so many notes from everything that that group was saying. It was just such a powerful and important moment to see that play out. And I think you're right. I think we talked a little bit up there about, we often say Utah is the crossroads of the West, and we've extended that it's really the crossroads of the world, and you're out to make it the crossroads of kindness around the world.
Why not? everything is possible, first in dream and next in reality. We should just do it.
Yeah.
And I think it was very well received. And that's what I'm saying. You know, in Utah, we have that ability to experience and do what the American dream is all about.
Yeah.
But not only in business and in commercial world, but in being individual and trying to do something that is the right thing for everybody, not only at this time, but for ages to come.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hoping that we all participate. And a number of people have, and I'm really very encouraged by the support that we're getting. And thank you to you as a moderator. You did a magic job over there.
It was such a gift to be. I kept saying it's the best thing that happened to me all week, and it was such a great way to spend it. I know this has a real personal connection for you, both in terms of your own history and coming here to the state and those who did show you acts of kindness early on. I know this also has a connection to your mother and of course, to the Family Foundation. Give us a little sense of that connection and why this is so important to you.
as I said, you know, we have all different backgrounds. I'm from Iran, and in Iran, there are many philosophers that they promoted kindness. And there's a old saying with kindness, they say, we all walk into a same room, only from different doors. Mm. You know, that room is kindness. Yeah. We just come from different doors.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And you know, when you plant a seed of kindness, you don't know how many good things is going to, that tree of kindness is going to bear. Yeah. And, you know, people, I really want to take the opportunity and thank Dr. Daniel Miles, who was my physics professor, who helped me to get a job. And also Dr. Henry Eyring, the father, who passed away many years ago. He helped me. I worked for him, and he helped me promote and get a better job and so on. And they were all so kind to me, and they grabbed my arm and pulled me up.
Yeah.
And I owe it to them. I really do owe it to them. And I'm just blessed that I can do this now for our community and bring back something that I learned when I was a child in Iran, and my teaching back then from my grandmother and my family, but also what I've learned here, I experienced here. Mm. It's time to give back, essentially. Yeah.
Fantastic. It is an extraordinary effort. It is not just a moment, not just an event. It is a movement that I think will continue to grow here, not just in the state of Utah, but across the country and around the world. Khosrow Simnani, extraordinary. Great to have you in today. Yes. Khosrow, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much for having me, Boyd.
This is an important conversation with Khosrow Simnani. He's one of those people that you've heard me describe before on this show. He's in the fingerprint business. He's not out there grabbing spotlights. He's not dominating stages. He's not trying to say, look at me. He's just out there making a difference, not just through simple acts of kindness, although I think that's where he begins and ends most of his days, but in so many important things that happen in this community that you would never, ever know that he had an influential role on, that he contributed to, that he helped support and sustain. He's really a master fingerprinter. And to me, those are my favorite kinds of leaders. They're the high-yield, low-maintenance kind of leader. They can lead from any point on the compass. They never have to have the microphone. They never have to be on the stage because they're just out there doing it. And what he's doing with the, you can go to thepowerofkind.org, powerofkind.org, and be part of this one kind act a day. It is making a huge difference, and we can all participate. I love that they're getting young people involved, schools being involved, businesses signing up and saying, hey, we're in. We're going to be part of that kind of movement. And this really brings our show full circle today. We started with Eboo Patel, president and founder of Interfaith America, who will be the keynote speaker, commencement speaker tonight up at the University of Utah, talking about how do we build bridges? How do we come together to solve problems? And one of the things that Eboo described to us that I think relates to what Khosrow Simnani just shared, and that is if we all come to the table, if we value the differences through kindness, we can get to this really magical space where everybody brings their unique gifts and ideas and talents and abilities and perspectives, and we all come to the table, and then together we enter this space of creative combination where you bring the best of you, I bring the best of me, and then through the kindness and the way we treat each other, we can have different conversations and we can experience that creative combination that always produces magical, extraordinary results in our neighborhoods and communities and in our country as well. Again, big thanks to Khosrow Simnani, the Simnani Family Foundation, and One Kind Act a Day. Well, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios,
this is KSL News Radio,
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.